You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Nathan Carter. Nathan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd. Nice to be here.
So I know you're living and working in Brooklyn now. What is it that you're working on? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. I'm making a film, and I've never made a film before. So it's actually humbling and frightening, and it's a kind of a, it's turned into a 2-year long project or saga or endeavor. It's a story about 4 women who graduate from high school, and at the kind of final graduation party, which is a rooftop party on top of their high school, two of them say, "Let's start a band." Which is a kind of classic story of, you know, like let's kind of try to make some songs or something like this. And they quickly find a bass player, who I think leads them to a drummer. And so their names are Molly Blowout is the singer. The guitar player is named Crimson Ivy, who she kind of sweeps all the ivies and wants to have a kind of visceral experience before going off to college. The bass player is named Melancholy, and she's a kind of like introverted sort of she has issues, let's say. And then the drummer is a kind of very like a tall Amazonian woman named Calamity. So it's Molly, Ivy, Melancholy, and Calamity. And they start a band, and they call themselves the Dramastics. And it's the kind of classic life arc of a band where they kind of they flare up and then they kind of flame out very quickly. Like, band has nothing, band tries hard, they write some songs, they play their first show at a roller discotheque, they record at an intimidating recording studio, they play a desert generator party, and then they fly to play their last show in Paris where they break up amicably.
And that's the whole arc of the film. It's the beginning of the band, from the, just the idea to the final dissolution of the band.
Yeah, exactly. And it happens very quickly, as lots of bands kind of like, you know, they start and then things happen potentially like too quickly, and then it kind of ends. And so I'm filming the whole thing just with a digital camera, and it's all using drawings and sculptures. I spent about a year and a half making dioramas for the sets, like, you know, the rooftop party I mentioned, a rehearsal studio. There's a scene with a gas station where they go for a snack, you know, like a 24/7 gas and go kind of place. And they at the gas station, they meet their rival band, the Cream and Demons, who are kind of these mean skateboarding guys that make fun of them. And then, you know, so there's a recording studio and some different shows that they play. And an airplane, or I should say a flying machine, because that's how they get around.
Well, you know, that sounds like a ton of fun. I mean, I'm really interested in kind of what you're doing and want to get into it more. But it also seems like, you know, you're a sculptor and you're, you know, as I see it, and you're making this movie, but you're also a writer. This has a whole narrative to it. And there's, it seems to me there's also like an arc in there that's about how how artists work. How does it feel to be doing this? It seems kind of huge compared to.
Yeah, it's terrifyingly huge. It's well, one thing is that, you know, like I'm an intuitive. So I normally kind of would, you know, go to my studio and I would kind of make something. It sort of happens, and I'm not writing anything first. There's nothing planned. I just kind of walk into my studio and I would kind of sit with some materials on my left-hand side and kind of process them with my hands, and then, you know, something comes out on the right. You know what I mean? And so this was a really, really different thing in that I started by writing a script. Actually, I should say that a friend of mine who's a book publisher in Paris met me at MoMA one day about 2 years ago, and we were in an Isa Genskin exhibition that was there. And I remember him, he's kind of he's an old kind of Parisian punk rocker and an instigator. And I remember he he took his two fingers and kind of jabbed them into my, just below my shoulder blade, which kind of is a really annoying thing to do. And he said to me, "You have to make a film." And I said, "Whoa, like, okay." And then he went, he did this kind of big arc with his hand and he said, "Look at this sculpture. It's, you know, it's such a mess. No one has any room for sculpture anymore." And he says it really loud, and everybody at MoMA in the galleries is looking at him like, "Who is this guy?" And I kind of like almost tried to walk away in that moment, like I don't know him. And he started trying to explain himself. You know, like if you made a film that you could tell a kind of a story and have it be a very portable thing, like a film gets on a hard drive. You know, and then it would be really different than having a sculpture show and just as something to try. And I think I'd been talking to him about wanting to tell stories more with the work. And then right around that time, I was making some Valentine's Day cards for my wife, and I drew some hearts. And I remember just suddenly out of the blue, I drew these two figures, and I'd never in my life drawn figures before. And it was just like, it just kind of happened. Like I drew a picture of my wife, which was really accurate, and then a kind of inaccurate drawing of myself where I looked a little bit like Zorro. And I thought, whoa, what's this? And I made these, that kind of led to some drawings that looked like actors on a stage, like really flamboyant looking drawings of actors and costumes in a kind of a surreal stage set. And I made a few more of those drawings, and they looked very complex. And I just thought, wow, this needs a story. And then, when my friend was saying to me, like, make a film, I thought, yeah, I'd like to do that. I'd like to kind of animate those actors. And then, right in that moment, I thought, I'm going to make a film about a band that I wish I was in.
Cool. I like that. It's interesting. Its relationship to sculpture, you know, because exactly as you said that, you know, though there are obviously more issues, but of course, like Matthew Barney, you know, sculptor, filmmaker, there's similar issues, I think, you know, with space and time in a way. But it's also, I mean, unlike what your friend was saying, it's true that people don't have space for maybe sculpture the way they do for film, but it's also quite a different kind of an object, right? I mean, it is it's no longer something that's unique or additioned or something. It's a it's a mass market medium.
Like that,
yeah.
I mean, the funny thing is that I remember in that moment when he said this thing to me. What he wanted me to do was work with like actors and directors and cinematographers and, you know, lighting people and costume people. And he really had this enormous kind of production in mind. And I thought instantly, like, no way. I'm doing it all with my hands, and I'm going to make everything. I'm going to make the music. I'm going to write a script. I'm going to, you know, like, yeah, all the characters have voices. So, like, the woman who cuts my hair is the drummer because she already sounds like a truck driver, and the bass player is kind of introvert. Is my friend Patricia Tribe, who's a painter, and she has a very, very, very deep voice with a kind of a really particular Detroit accent to it. And the Crimson Ivy, the kind of student, the scholar on the guitar, she's played by my friend Danielle Benedetti, who's just recently graduated from NYU and sounds like she's, you know, the kind of girl that's walked into telephone poles reading books when she was growing up. And the singer is played by my friend Trinity Lewis, who actually she helped me write the script a lot. And she has this, you know, kind of Southern California vibe to her that you'd need for the voice of a singer.
So this is becoming a very large collaboration as well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I do have, you know, like I mentioned, the woman who helped me write a script, Trinity, she had just recently graduated from Duke University and was in the acting and writing an art program there. And so I kind of quickly thought, like, oh, if I get her to help me write the script, I'll have the voice of someone who's much closer in age to how these characters sound. And I started actually going out at night with her and her friends and kind of like buying them drinks and listening to how they talk in this like quick staccato, multi-platform social media, you know, everything is in acronyms and word, everything is abbreviated and the language is flying around and the hair is flying around, and it was this whole kind of adolescent female energy that I was attracted to and I wanted to listen to and hear and be around in order to write a script.
It sounds really exciting. How long will it be, and when do you project it'll be finished?
Okay, so I have a deadline, which is I'm making a solo exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, Colorado, working with a director curator there named Adam Lerner, and that opens on September 28th in Denver. So I have to have it done by then. And I'm close to filming the last couple of big scenes that take place in Paris when the band breaks up. It's like their final show. And my camera fell over the other night, so that was a little bit of a setback that was bound to happen eventually. As we were moving lights around, the tripod fell over. So I learned a big lesson about the reason for sandbags at that moment. Always secure your tripod. It's a learning arc, and I will go to editing in the next month or so, mastering the music, recording vocals. Basically, I'm making a radio show, a story that you hear on the radio, but with visuals. So it's a kind of a two-part process.
So how long will the whole piece be? Do you imagine feature length or?
So at some point someone said to me, like, you know, to get into a film festival, it has to be under 12 minutes long. And I don't want to show it at film festivals. I'd rather show it at museums. And that number stuck with me as something, as like a duration that I could probably stand sitting for. And I thought, it's not stop motion because I don't really have the patience for that. It's like filming a puppet show. So these paper figures are moving around in dioramas, and I'm hoping, really hoping to keep it, you know, in the 12 to 15 minute range.
Afterwards, like it'll be shown. Do you imagine this will be part of exhibits in the future? Will you make more films, or what? I know that's kind of hard to project, but you know, I'm kind of interested what will happen to the whole life of all the objects in the film, as well as the film itself, once it's
made.
That's
a great question. I started, you know, it's interesting, like with the work that I've been making before, like, you know, for the last, I mean, since I moved to New York and was making sculpture and drawings, and I never, ever had conversations with curators. It just never happened. All of my conversations were with galleries, and it was something that I thought was starting to become a problem in some ways. And then all of a sudden, when I started making this film, instantly, it was like overnight, anytime I sat down with a curator, there was just a discussion to be had about, you know, like, what do you show? Do you show just the film? Do you show the dioramas? Because those are a real thing. I mean, I'm in my studio right now, and I'm turning around, and it's, I've got about, they're like, you know, it's like eight pieces of sculpture that are kind of completely unlike anything I've made before, and they're pretty elaborate sets. And so I started, you know, asking them, like, how would you show this? I get a different range of responses. Like, one curator might be, say, like, well, I'm a purist, and so you only want to show the film. And then you get another curator saying, well, you know, you're not a filmmaker, you're a sculptor, so then we show everything. And that's, I think, maybe at the moment appealing to me because I'm so proud of these sets that I've made and the characters that I've developed that I want to show everything together. So in the exhibition at the MCA in Denver, I'll show everything. And then that turned into this thing of showing absolutely everything in my studio, including all of the kind of, you know, ephemera and sketches and drawings that I've made to kind of create the project or to develop the characters and the look of the whole thing.
That's really interesting. So that makes sense, right? Because now curating this isn't a simple task at all, how the whole thing gets set up. With the film, I mean, in terms of curating it, so let's say all of that's done, it's this kind of big installation, will work be available independently? Like, would you sell off parts of essentially the sets of all of this, or no?
Well, yeah, that's another really good question. So like I was saying, that, you know, for a long time I kind of had this, it was like a dialogue almost with galleries. I'm talking about commercial galleries, right, where I would be making
right.
things. And it was very, very clear to me from the get-go that it's like that's the endeavor, that it's like I make something, give it to them, they sell it. End of story. And I think there was a point maybe like 3 years ago when I started coming home from the studio a little earlier every day, and my wife was like, what are you doing? Why are you here? And I kind of thought, huh, like, yeah, that is a good question. Like, I'm making these things. It was a little bit of a missing a little bit, maybe emotionally in the work. And it started to become really clear that something needed to change, and I knew it. And when I started making these stories or this story about this group, everything that I made was so precious to me that there's just no way I would sell it at all. And I thought, that is a huge flag. Like, what's going on here? This is, you know, I could call it a red flag, like a good red flag, you know. Also, the fact that my gallerist, as you call him, Casey Kaplan, I remember he came over to my studio. He said to me when I started, when he was just first looking at the beginnings of the film, and he kind of couldn't really wrap his head around, like, what's all, like, what is he doing, you know? And I remember he said to me, are you going to make any art while you make the film? And I thought, whoa, like, that's another big, that was more of a red flag, like a proper red flag, you know, like,
right.
What is he talking about? Like, well, of course, I am making art. Like, this is art. You know, like, what's the difference? And I mean, one way of looking at it is that, like, last August when I had $15 in my account, that was his, what he was trying to tell me became really, really clear to me. I took a real break from this thing of, like, making work, sending it to the gallery. You know, it's been good in that way.
But also this is, right, it's a very different relationship between, just as you're talking to curators differently now, it's a different relationship with your gallerist, because they are used to selling objects from you, sculptures,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. 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 Sculptures and drawings, yeah, for a long time. So yeah,
how is he handling that?
He and I are really, really close friends, and I've noticed our conversation has changed from like a very pragmatic conversation to a very personal conversation. And that is also, I think, been probably good for both of us. It's probably a little bit healthier in a way, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense that it's healthier, of course. That's a great, there's something, the red flag that you mentioned initially is in a way this kind of questioning about, you know, is it art or not, and are you also making art, makes it that much more art, makes it, you know, all the more a kind of almost kind of magical moment. What artists are searching for, right? That which doesn't quite look like art, but it is, and is taking it down a path that is completely unexpected, it seems.
Sure. I mean, you know, like, I feel like when an artist gets completely lost in some kind of process that they're doing, that's got to be a good moment. You know, when they're not thinking about pragmatics and they're thinking about, like, you wake up and you go to sleep every day thinking about, like, what's this thing that I'm trying to, the story that I'm trying to tell, or what's the, what's it going to look like, and not thinking about like, oh, I need to make something this size so it fits inside of a crate, and going to this city, and this is my deadline, you know. Yeah, the getting lost part is fantastic, and just, you know, kind of coping with the fear of that every day is also a nice, well, I shouldn't say it's a nice thing, but it's a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing. It's a different thing. It seems to me a more, well, yeah, I mean, let's not put words on it, but obviously, like, something really good is happening there. There's some, you know, in my mind, a little bit of magic happening there. That's what we're, yeah, we're after. So to be pragmatic then, when you got out of school, after getting an MFA, what were the first shows you got? What was happening then? How did those enter? Just to get a kind of, I'll move through that kind of quickly, but just to get a trajectory of how we got up to this point.
Yeah,
what,
I mean, I remember
the first show that you got, and what were you thinking? Yeah,
I mean, you know, it's interesting. Like, I maybe just to like backtrack a tiny bit, because I got my MFA from Yale in the late '90s, and when I got there, I kind of knew pretty quickly that there was something that was different about my art school background in relation to my peers in that MFA program, which is that a lot of them had come from university programs, but they were all very comfortable in academia, and they knew, oh, they all had like a Hal Foster book and the Rosalind Krauss book, and, you know, and they had like a leather satchel and nice clothing, and they would kind of, they were facile with language, and I kind of showed up with my skateboard and my bass guitar and was like, hey, you know, here I am. And I quickly figured out that, like, you know, I was kind of making things, and I couldn't really talk about them. In fact, I think they, prior to me being in the MFA program, there was never a rule that, like, when you made your thesis exhibition, that you had to write something in addition to making work. And I think they changed the rule for me because I was so kind of clearly, like, couldn't write that they had me kind of write something, and that actually became fun for me quickly, like writing little vignettes and stories about things and trying to make my own language. And so, and I guess the other side of that is, like, you know, I was making objects. And so when I left school and moved to New York, I kind of had a studio practice already. Like, it wasn't something I was starting up. It just kind of, like, I got a studio pretty quickly and South Williamsburg, and I started making things, and I think within 6 months I had a piece in a group show at Friedrich Petzl, and I think Casey Kaplan saw that piece and then came over to my studio. I did a group show
at Friedrich Petzl. Let's just back up a little bit. How did that happen? That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, you know, it almost, like, I don't remember quite how it happened, except that there were, it was a summer group show, you know, and it was done not by Friedrich, it was done by people who worked in the gallery, who organized the show, and I had this big sculpture there that looked kind of like a cross between a space station and a roller coaster, kind of very large, tall sculpture that looked like a gang of fourth graders got, you know, boxes of Legos and started making something. It wasn't made out of Legos, but it was made out of like cardboard boxes and wood and tape and paper, and that was a interesting thing to make that. I mean, I was pretty unaware of what was happening. Like, I just made something and it was kind of just rolled out of me in a way, and I didn't think at that time a lot about the context I was showing it in. I just kind of did it. And then I had a project room show at Artist Space. And I think it was those two things, and Casey saw that and came over to my studio. And I might have shown him a slideshow of like unrelated images that I liked at that time, which were a lot of kind of vintage auto racing images, football hooligans, probably like pictures of working boats, like tugboats, freighters, airplanes, you know, like things that moved around, like anything you'd see in a Richard Scarry children's book, or, you know, spaces where people go to and through, like train stations. And I was kind of really excited about those images. And I think he, and I showed him the slideshow, and I pretty quickly gave him his jacket and said, like, thanks for coming, you know? And he was kind of like, whoa, wait a minute, hold on. And yeah, within a couple of months, we were starting to kind of show. And I did my first show about a year after that. I didn't have a lot of chance. Like I mentioned, being in one summer group show, that's all I got. I didn't get to do this thing that a lot of artists do for a while of being in group shows. And I missed that in a way, that like thing of having no pressure, you know, just, you just show a piece with your friends and then you make friends and stand outside on the sidewalk having a beer. And I immediately had to kind of make a show. And I remember I made some sculptures, and the first thing I did was, because they were in an art gallery, I had to sand them. Like, they, I know, like, what a shame that I thought that. But I mean, yeah, that was 15 years ago, and I didn't know what I was doing. So,
and that was Casey Kaplan. That's when you began showing with Casey Kaplan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've been working together for about 15 years. I think we've done 5 or 6 shows or something like that.
And in all that time, so that's how things began. I'm glad you backtracked and told that story. Now what's happening is you're making this film, and there's really a transition, as you're saying, in how you're working with Casey Kaplan, because the relationship changes now. Now you're like mature enough not to have to think that you have to sand down the corners. In fact, you're doing the complete opposite of sanding the corners right now.
Yeah,
right.
Now I'm doing my job. Now I'm like letting it rip, which is great. I mean, you know, it's a kind of it's like a real eye-opening experience. And the thing that I'm curious about is like what comes next, you know? And I mean, along with the drawings of all the, like I was mentioning, drawing these kind of Valentine's Day cards, like drawing the clothing on these characters, and a lot of the characters have long flowing dresses. And they have a kind of a flamboyant look to them. And I started buying crepe de chine silk and dyeing that with colors that are different than the primary colors I was kind of using for a long time, that I would associate with, like, flags, sports team regalia, Legos, DeSteel, Miro, Calder, all of those, you know, like my old dead friends from a long time ago, post-war design and painting. And I kind of made a break from that. So like, if you go into my studio now, it's much more, the colors are much softer and the forms are softer also. Which is, at first when I started making this stuff, I thought, I can't show this. This is so pretty.
Right.
Yeah, I wasn't brave enough to show it at first. And I remember showing some of the people who work at Casey's gallery, all women, you know, and I'm showing them, but like not showing Casey. And I felt more comfortable talking with women, I guess, to make a long story short, that somehow It was like made for them to kind of like consume or look at, and not for like some guy to come in and look at and assess and, you know, decide, oh, do I show this or not? And I was really coy about like what they were at first, like, oh, they're gifts. And I kind of made up a story that they're gifts for a group of women, when it's really just, you know, like, yeah.
It's really just what you want to do. It's simply what you're doing in your studio on one level.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to see how that developed. Does this affect your own kind of economy? I mean, I imagine you're already working other jobs as well. Casey Kaplan was never kind of like the paycheck for you, right?
Well, I mean, that's yet again a good question. I teach also. I teach at Princeton. I teach a drawing class, and some other small teaching things here and there. But yeah, I mean, I think in a way, you know, when you're an artist and you live in this city, and you were around during the mid 2000s, I think a lot of artists probably thought, oh, this is, I'll just be an artist. Like, you know, this is kind of before the banking system almost fell apart. And that changed things. I think that kind of, you know, 2008 opened things up in a way. And I think that artists have a lot more freedom in that moment.
Freedom in the sense of like financial freedom, you mean? Like in what sense?
Well, like in the sense that you don't think that you can just make money making art. It's just, you know, it's like most artists I know teach, they have jobs, they, you know, it's I think maybe a closer relationship to having like a real life as opposed to living in a fantasy land.
Right. It's been great talking to you. I'd like to close by just asking you a question I've been asking recently, which is there a book you're reading lately that doesn't have to be on topic at all, could be, but just anything that you're reading that you could mention or share with us?
Well, you know, I don't read that much, but I listen a lot. And at the moment, I've been like being really kind of like having this strong desire to change a lot of the music that I listen to and pull new music in. So a lot of the, you know, like I mentioned, I teach, so I'm constantly asking students what they're listening to, and I call them my film crew, or the squad that comes over and helps me film once a week. Every time I kind of say, as soon as they come into the studio, like, okay, you plug in and you DJ and you know play the music in the studio while we're working, and I'm constantly running over and taking photographs of their like, you know, their cell phone screens when it's plugged into a PA system, and I'm getting all of this amazing new music, and then I'll kind of like read about these. It's mostly electronic music. It's kind of like really aggressive. It's like trap music. It has this quality that there's always like a big giant bass drop, like the payoff of the song. And there's this moment they all wait for it. And so I'm kind of been reading about in my own way. Like I don't read books. I read, you know, kind of fairly well written stuff about whatever it is that I'm interested in. Hopefully it's well written. I'm reading about music that's coming from Atlanta, to make a long story short.
And that's music that's coming from Atlanta now. This is being produced.
Well, now and in the last, probably the last, you know, like 8 years or so.
Is there a band in particular that you like that's typical of what's coming from Atlanta?
Sure.
Is that too general?
Migos. And well, actually, he's from New Jersey, but it's Fetty Wap. I would say, like, you know, listen to Trap Queen. And if you're of a certain age, you'd be like, oh, yeah, I know that song. That was last summer's song. But, I mean, it's the song, Trap Queen.
Nathan, thanks so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks so much, Brainerd. It's been nice.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.